Oh, yeah, we're going to do it good here today. Happy Friday. Welcome to Express Yourself, where creativity and conversation collide. We have a great show this week. Libby Reif and playwright Stephen Nemirovsky, known as Nemo, is here to talk about their participation in TRTC's The Workshop. Artist Tracy Harris stops by before her opening exhibition at the launch pad tonight. And Sarah Ransford and Hunter Hogan discuss their upcoming exhibition at the Art Base. And to top it off, Hamilton Pevick fills us in on the Eagle Mushroom and Wild Food Fest happening now through Sunday. Whew. It's a big weekend in August, so get ready. I'm your host, Amy Kimberly. So tune in to Turn On. Just gonna bring that on down because we got so much to talk about here. I am extremely excited to have Libby and Nemo in the studio. The show is called Free Florida and it premieres tomorrow night, August 22nd, at Thunder River Theater. And wow, it's in a workshop form. And it just seems like a very powerful and timely piece that is happening here. And so I don't even know where to start, but let's start with you, Nemo. And it's very interesting. It says that your bio says you're a speaker, college professor, lobbyist, television host, and author whose career centers on understanding, and this is the important part, and fixing America's polarized and dysfunctional political system. That's big, the fixing part.
Yeah, fixing gets harder all the time, unfortunately, because the problem gets bigger all the time.
Yeah, and so this piece that Libby is...
the Democratic candidate.
Yes. Female, first female...
Correct.
Candidate. Does it work out some of your thoughts on how things should go, or is it showing where the weaknesses are in the system? Yeah.
This story actually has two different pieces that meet together. The one piece is that Libby's running for president, and if she wins, she's going to be the first female president. At the same time, we have a billionaire from Aspen named Atlas who has tried to start a third party. And I think everybody wishes we could have a third party, but we never get there. He decides on a more drastic solution, which is a secession movement. He's going to ask the state of Florida to secede from the country. And we now have the clash of these two powerhouses. We have Libby wants to be the president so she can save democracy, and Atlas wants to force a secession movement so he can save democracy. And they intersect in some extremely interesting ways.
Oh, I bet. And you have been really delving into this third party issue for quite a while. You wrote maybe three novels?
I've written two novels of what was intended to be a trilogy. The story that people can come and see this weekend would be one day in the third book that I haven't written yet.
Oh, so interesting. So, Libby, how has it been? You're working directly with the playwright, and it's kind of a reading. Can you explain how the workshop goes?
Yeah, it's a fascinating process, and it's something that Missy really wants to forward at Thunder River. One of her favorite things to do, in fact, is the new play development series that we call the Writer's Workshop. And we get these amazing local playwrights, and they do an incredible thing. They take their script, their baby, and they turn it over to a bunch of creatives who just jump all over it, and we work with it intensely for a week. We give suggestions, we form ideas, and at the end of the week, we put on the performance. Now, we're on book, but the show is staged. It's as fully realized as a workshop can be, and it's just a fascinating process. And Nemo has been wonderful to work with because while he has been in this arena for, I want to say, 30 years politically, he is willing to listen to a bunch of artists who you know, we're grounded in theater. And so we have an idea of how his work can best be presented on the stage. And I thought it was a fascinating process the whole week, and we're really excited to put it on. And talk about a timely piece. I mean, it's, and for those of you out there that are kind of burned out on politics, just know that this is a different angle. It's invigorating. It's that it will leave you with, what if this could happen, and what could become of it, and what kind of chaos could occur where we could actually resurrect our democracy. And that's what the show deals with.
Yeah. And so for you as the playwright, Nemo, what did you learn from these guys?
I learned two things, one of which I kind of already knew. The talent level in this valley is off the charts. And at Thunder River, it's off the charts. Missy put together an entire team. So I have the actor and actresses available to me. We have a dramaturg.
Kayla Henley.
We have a very accomplished writer. We have Missy. So there's a whole team that's been gathering around a table for 20-some hours already this week, beating me up, but getting this to a better place. But, again, you just come back to the talent level, and you get into a room with someone named Libby who you've never met before, and you just are reminded of how talented everybody in this valley can be and is.
So how did Thunder River come to be with you in this particular thing, or did you find Thunder River?
I kind of found them because I've been writing different versions of this. As you said, I wrote a couple books. I've written it as a movie. I've written it as what I'd really like to see realized one day, a TV series where you can tell a story over 8 or 9 episodes or even over more. And the most recent version I wrote was inspired by the solo acts at Aspen Theater. And I wrote it for one actress, which would have been Libby. But in the process, to show you how we've grown this week, in the process of doing it this week, we're now going to have 3 people on the stage, not just one, because I'm learning how theater works. And everybody said to me, theater works better if the audience can see the people live, not just hear their voices and watch them. So they've maybe turned this in a bunch of different directions, and I've had a great time.
And he's been so flexible, which has been wonderful, because we did bring more bodies on the stage, which makes my job a lot easier. It's feels a lot more authentic to be able to act with someone on the stage as opposed to a Zoom call or just on the phone. And there's some of that, too, because she is isolated in ICU. Hospital. I don't need to give you all the details of the show, but she cannot be at the convention. And so that's why there's just all this turmoil and people coming in. And Atlas is talking to her about Free Florida, and she's trying to land the nomination. And she makes some pretty radical decisions that are definitely worth coming and watching.
Yeah.
Because I think it's fair to say that we're all quite concerned about our democracy, and the experiment is not over. And this show really demonstrates that.
And as you explained, too, it's like you have to wait till the end to see what she decides.
Yes.
You're on this journey with her, I imagine. And so you got to stay, and, you know, it intrigues you just like a mystery or anything else.
Yes, and Emma Michaels is an interesting candidate because she kind of came to it accidentally. She was a school teacher, a coach. She took her father's congressional seat when he died suddenly and then became governor. And so politics has kind of swept her up, where she doesn't have a lot of political ambition, but what she wants to do and what she stands in, I think, the whole production, because of the way Nemo wrote it, is she is determined to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so for her, her arc in this show is, what is the best way that I can make a difference for this country? Her loyalty to her loved ones and to the country and democracy is immeasurable. Mm-hmm. And so she wrestles with it the whole time and then comes to a decision on how she can make the most difference.
And one thing I've learned is I come from politics, but I'm traveling more in theater and in the world of entertainment. The word that gets beaten into you is drama, drama, drama. So we've packed this with a lot of drama, and she gets tested
constantly,
back and forth for an hour. And we're throwing things at her, and she's having to deal with them. But as things get thrown to her, it awakenings ideas in her that hadn't been there in a while. And she has to now say, what direction do I really think we have to go here, as Libby said, to save our democracy? And that's what it's about here. Our political system is not working.
No, we want you to be our savior.
What is it going to take to get it to work? And that's what I want the people to leave the theater with. I'm not necessarily giving them an answer, but I'm giving them some roadmaps of what it might take.
Well, so as a writer and a political figure, you know, that follows all of this and writes a lot about it, could you ever have written the reality of these last 4 years or 8 years?
I love that question, because I said to people, you know, I go to the library, wherever I go to write, and I always say, I could not make up the stuff that happens every day. And it's a challenge, because I want to get my story out and be able to, well, that's just boring compared to what's going on in Washington right now.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? God. I always say, oh, if we'd watched this all in a movie, we would have laughed. It would have been a comedy. We would have enjoyed it. But we go, oh, but that would never happen.
Yeah, we're not laughing now.
Right. Yeah. Well, will a third party ever happen?
I'm going to say I don't think it can. But why I'm going to tell you I think it can is that both parties right now are facing major upheaval.
Yeah.
Both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And when both parties are facing upheaval, the question is, does that open a lane in the middle?
Mm-hmm.
Where you could peel off elements of both parties, you could say, you know what, we got to work together to get back to the middle. We have to get together to start solving some problems.
Mm-hmm.
So the further out the polarization gets, that opens more of a lane in the middle. And I've been a believer for a long time that a third party, even if it doesn't succeed, can put enough pressure on everybody else to make them start doing their jobs, that it brings the system back to the middle.
Yeah, and that's interesting. It would be the middle, not either end. You know, the further end it gets, it stops working as well. The third party would have to be the middle, which is very interesting. Yeah,
and I'm old enough to remember we used to have the silent majority.
Right.
Now I think we have the disgusted majority.
Yeah.
So the question is, would the disgusted majority ever coalesce around a concept that said to the system, you better start working?
Yeah, fascinating. So in the workshop that is happening tomorrow, these are like some of the kind of ideas that might be thrown out there in different ways, or, you know, how our political system works for one person trying to maneuver through their life of humanity and their life of politics, which seems like we've lost some of our humanity in politics.
And that's exactly what she's wrestling with. Mm-hmm. And how can she hold on to it, mm-hmm, and also be in a position where she can truly make a difference? And what's great about the workshop is after the show, the audience is presented with questions, and so they also get to contribute to the process and to the playwright.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, and it's only one night. You know, it's just tomorrow night at 7:30.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a really hot weekend, and the theater is beautiful and cool, and so you can take a break from the heat and dive into this political drama.
Yeah, yeah. You go to Thunder River Theater, and theater is re.org, and you can get tickets. I think there's only 100 available, but you could also come to the door if for some reason you didn't get any and hope to
Right,
get
or
in.
You can call the box office, and I think it's ThunderRiverTheater.com.
Oh, it's a .com.
Yeah.
Should be a .org. It's a nonprofit.
Yeah. Right.
But so is Carbondale. Yeah.
And it's a very affordable ticket, too. Yeah. So it's a winner all the way around.
Well, that's fabulous. I actually hope that tomorrow night is not the only time this shows. Hopefully it can be developed into a full-scale production that more people will have a chance to see.
And that does happen. I mean, Beyond Reason is being produced this year. We've been working with Kristen Carlson during this process, and her play went through the writer's workshop, and now it's being fully produced this fall.
And for you, Nemo, where can people find it more about you? Because it's fascinating. I'd love to do a whole hour show with you. So do tell us.
Well, I'll come back and we'll do the hour. I used to have a website, but I don't anymore, so you really can't look me up. But as we were talking earlier, I've got a show on Grassroots and Aspen, come to think of it. And just a plug for that, because I wrote my books, and I know how hard it is for a writer to get your message out. I'm trying to give people that write interesting new books a voice. Mm-hmm. And we've covered some pretty interesting books there, too. So I don't want people to learn about me as much as I want them to learn about some of my guests as you want them to learn about your guests and see the great work that people are doing.
Come to think of it, folks, on Grassroots TV. Well, thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Amy.
And I can't wait to see how this play develops, because it's so timely. And I really appreciate people writing things like this so that we can open up for discussion.
And we appreciate KDNK for letting us come on and give it a plug.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, now you have to go rehearse, I
Correct.
Guess. All right. See ya.
Thank you, Amy.
We are now going to play just a little Grateful Dead, because why not? It's that kind of day. And this weekend, Terrapin Roadshow happening at Two Rivers. Well, there will be no members of the Grateful Dead at Terrapin Roadshow, but there are going to be some incredible musicians there honoring the dead. And Graham Lesh, son of bassist Phil Lesh, will be there leading the charge. So it should be a fun day in the park tomorrow. And now, I am so lucky to have in the studio Tracy Harris. She's an extraordinary woman and artist whose work is known throughout the country and even beyond a little bit. But she's been living here for 10 years.
For 10 and Colorado for 15.
Yeah, she's part of us. But we have not been able to see her work showing right here in the Valley, and we are so excited. It will be at the launch pad, the Carbondale Arts Gallery. Tonight is the opening, and it's called, I love the name of the show, You Don't Have to Be Perfect, But You Could Try Harder. Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the titles on my book, one of my book series, and I have a series of books, and I paint different titles on. I make up parodies of self-help books and things like that.
Yeah, and that is definitely one of the things you are known for, but also your kind of realism style, but in very humorous fantasy, political, cultural absurdity ways. Like, mm-hmm. there's always something that draws you in besides what you just see immediately, mm-hmm. and takes you places. And I would say, you know, in the work that I've seen of yours, it's there's a lot of diverse. There's the book series, and then there's your figure series. Mm-hmm. But your style is mm-hmm. is very distinct. And I'm just wondering how you came upon that style.
Thank you. Well, I consider myself a contemporary realist, and I was an abstract painter for years, and I felt like I had good ideas that I wasn't able to express, so I decided to start painting more realistically, and so I was a little bit self-taught in that, although I had foundation in that from college. But I just like adding a little humor, and I like the figurative series to be, you know, not just looking at an object woman, but like a subject that's actually doing something and shows the range of what women do.
Yeah. And it also feels like it's something that you're channeling to some of your own emotions in certain ways. It's like if there's something that's really bothering you about society, mm-hmm. or things you want to point out, mm-hmm. you do it in a, you know, it's not subtle, but I'm kind of jealous. I'm like, oh, I'd love to be able to do things like that.
I have one piece in the show called Current Mood, Taking the Edge Off, and it's myself lighting a cigar on a Molotov cocktail. Uh-huh. And I feel like it resonates with people, mm-hmm. and I feel like that most days, and so that's how I originate the paintings.
You say that so nicely, and that's how I feel most days. Well, how did the book series start?
So about 20 years ago, I did this really complicated homage to Duchamp. And it was all these book pieces that had art history titles. And, you know, I really can't explain it. You'd have to see it. But from that, someone said, well, you know, you can't reinvent the wheel every painting, and it can't be this complicated. So I was trying to think of how I could do a series. And I was like, well, what book would I want to read? Mm-hmm. And so my very first book title that I came up with was How to Unfuck Stuff Up. And so I just painted that on the book. And then I just continued to make up different titles that were psychology-based. And it's a fun way for me to do a little, you know, social commentary. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's how they started.
And how did you start? You know, you're in galleries all over. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, because we have so many artists in this valley, but getting into galleries is not that easy, mm-hmm. for people. So how did that path work for you?
So, yeah, it's important to start locally, I think. My first gallery was in Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And as you start selling work, they begin giving you more solo exhibitions. And from that, other galleries will see you. And so that was the only gallery I had to go in and cold call and say, hey, will you take my work? Wow. And then from there, galleries started contacting me, which I feel really fortunate. So,
yeah, that really is. And living in Marble, has that affected the way you paint in any way through these 20 years, what do you keep discovering in your style?
I don't feel like living in marble has really changed anything. I feel like my art practice and my life are very separate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I love the piece.
Yeah.
So
it's harder
that.
To get groceries.
It is. Yeah.
But you basically paint, though, at your home, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But mm-hmm. you're able to keep them separate, like you have certain times you go in and you paint.
Yeah.
And then out. So putting together this show, what were there, what does that mean you could, you know, try hard? Like, how did you come up with that name? I know it was on a book, but, like, what made you choose that for this show?
I feel like it should be a theme for everyone right now.
It's true. I yeah. live by that.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many things that I could say about that. But, I mean, we all right now have to try harder.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your figures. You do have some of those in mm-hmm. the show as well. And, you know, a lot of paintings that I have seen of yours, and I believe there might be a few of these in the show, you have women mm-hmm. figures, mm-hmm. which I believe is it mainly like you feel yourself in that figure.
Mm-hmm.
And with like, not heavy machinery, but chainsaws, things that you wouldn't mm-hmm. normally maybe put together with a...
Yeah, so one of the series that I'm showing is called Caution, Women with Orange Objects.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I'll have myself with a chainsaw or wrapped in a power cord, and I'm plugging into the power cord, or an orbital sander sanding off a piece of china. So it's all just kind of aggressive. And then a lot of it's from life experiences and being an independent person and... Mm-hmm. You know, just thugging through it.
Yeah, it's an incredible series. I really, I'm glad you've got some of those pieces in the show, and people will get to see them. And then you also have some of the book series.
Yeah, I think there's at least 10 from my book series, and there's a couple of rubber chicken paintings.
Oh, yeah, talk about the rubber chicken paintings.
So about 20 years ago, I was thinking about, like, the Flemish paintings of meat mm-hmm. and, like, mm-hmm. how luscious they were. And so I was wondering what a contemporary version of that would be. So I came up with the rubber chickens. And as I was lighting them, I hung them upside down, and I lit them, and I noticed that their feet made this shadow on a wall that looks like some kind of existential squawk. And so every time I have an art opening, like a solo show, I put in a rubber chicken painting.
Look at that. And Tracy, you might come across as fairly serious when people first meet you, but really we know.
Yeah.
Underneath that is just a bubbling sense of humor that somehow helps get us through life, because it sure isn't easy.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, well, I am very excited to come over to the opening, which is tonight over at the Launchpad. Starts at 5, will mm-hmm. go till about 7. And then the show hangs through September.
Mm-hmm.
And it is on display with another show. It's a tiny print show.
And that show is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't had a chance yet to look at all the pieces, but it's pretty striking.
Yeah, it looks really good. I have been by, you know, every day, but I haven't seen everything finished and complete mm-hmm. between the two shows. I will probably say I think people are going to have to go back several times
yeah.
while these shows are hanging to really take mm-hmm. it in. But should be a good time tonight. Where can people find out more about you?
On social media, I'm Tracy, T-R-A-C-E-Y, Harris Artist. And same with Facebook, Tracy Harris, T-R-A-C-E. Why?
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming by.
Yes, thank you.
I will see you in a little bit
okay.
over at We're at the launch pad. All right, you guys, here's another just because tomorrow I'm just celebrating Broke Down Palace. Bring this down because I love this song. But I have a little piece. Hamilton Pevick and I got together just the other day about the Mushroom Fest. And it's just a wonderful thing. It's happening right now. So listen in. I'm here with Hamilton Pevick. You are the creator of the Eagle Mushroom and Wild Food Festival?
That's correct. Last year I took over as the executive director, and we're doing our 17th year.
Wow, 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my, that's amazing. What fueled you to take it over first off?
It felt very serendipitous. My brother Lucien and I were looking for an event to throw our weight behind. We had experimented with doing the Bayul Mushroom Retreat for a couple of years, and that was difficult in different ways. And then we were also involved in the Telluride Mushroom Festival for the last 5 years. And the previous organizers of the Eagle Mushroom Fest reached out to us right at the right time and said, you know, this is an all-volunteer organization. We're kind of tired of doing it. Would you take it over? And it was exactly the right time for me to say yes. I'm excited about doing it.
And for those of you that don't know in our listening audience, Hamilton Pevick is the owner of Hamilton's Mushrooms. So it makes sense. You should be curating a mushroom festival. And this one is just chock full of such great things. And the first question I want to ask you is, before you took it over, was the wild food part of it?
Yes. Yeah, they've always been a little food leaning in terms of, I mean, it's like mushroom foraging, but also there's a bunch of workshops and fancy meals and shared meals and cooking classes. And so it sort of leans to the culinary side of things. Like, three of the four workshops that we're doing this year are tastings and food demos. Then we also have a cultivation workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of food adjacent. And then we're doing, like, we have a mycelial mixer with mushroom treats and drinks. And then we're doing a big family pizza party at the end where we basically take all of our leftovers on Sunday night and make a bunch of pizzas and eat the mushroom ID table.
That sounds quite yummy, as long as it's the non-psychedelic mushroom.
Well, there are psychedelic mushrooms that grow in Colorado. However, they are very rare. And if we find one, it will be legendary.
and eaten,
yes,
but maybe not in the...
maybe we'll raffle the one who gets to eat the one Colorado magic mushroom we find.
Wow. So it happens this weekend. It's already starting by time this airs.
Right.
Because this airs Friday afternoon, and you get right into it on Friday morning.
That's right. Doors will open at noon, and then there's going to be a workshop at 1 and then another one at 3. And then we're going to all dress up as mushrooms and march across Eagle to our mycelial mixer, where we'll offer free food and drinks to anyone who wants to come and join us.
Oh, that's sweet. And where does that happen in Eagle?
That's at Foodsmith Prep Kitchen, which is this classroom kitchen run by Elena Smith, who's an amazing chef and forager. And she's hosting our mycelial mixer and leading hands-on cooking class on Saturday morning, which actually we need to sell one more ticket to in order to make happen. I know it's Friday that you're listening to this, but join the class. It's $120. She's making this brunch. It's like a multi-course brunch that you get to eat at the end of it in a kitchen classroom environment.
That's amazing. And that would be on Saturday morning, right?
That's right.
Well, tell me about John Michelotti.
John Michelotti.
Michelotti.
Okay. Yeah, he is this very, well-known and experienced mycologist based out of the East Coast who runs a mushroom company and does foraging and is deeply involved in the Telluride Mushroom Festival. He's one of these figures that I had been hearing about for many years before I actually got to meet him, and then was pleasantly surprised to find out he was my age when I imagined him to be one of our mushroom elders all this time.
See, well, you'll be a mushroom elder before long.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess, yeah. Hopefully, if I keep at it, right?
Yeah.
I'm wearing the old bold mushroom hunter shirt right now, which is a skeleton walking in the forest. So John is one of these mycologists who speaks poetically and profoundly about mushrooms in general, and knows how to inspire awe and imagination and inspiration in the people who listen to him speak. So I invited him to do our opening keynote address.
Oh, nice.
You know, with the aim to just remind us about how much we all love mushrooms and why they're so cool.
Oh, that sounds excellent. And that's at 7 o'clock on Friday evening. So even if you didn't make it during the day, you could shoot over. I mean, Eagle's only 4 to 5 minutes from this area.
Yeah, it's at the Brush Creek Pavilion, which is easy to get to. It's in this beautiful park, kind of in the new part of Eagle. And from the Roaring Fork Valley, it's a short drive. It's definitely worth it. And it's a really unique, intimate community because it's just one venue where we all gather.
Yeah, that's very exciting, except when you're actually gathering and you're foraying, which it looks like happens pretty early every morning around 7:30 a.m. And where's the spots? No. How does it all work? Everyone meets and then you kind of go to one area?
Yeah, there's going to be 8 groups of 12 people each on Saturday and Sunday, led by expert forager ID people, like all people mostly from the Colorado community. And you learn about mushroom identification. We're going to go up into the White River National Forest, where we have permits in order to lead these expert guided forays. And we're going to gather at cafes downtown in Eagle and then drop you off back at the cafe so that you can grab your breakfast and your lunch before and after the foray. These are the most unique offerings that we have, because learning about mushrooms from people who care passionately about mushrooms is the way to do it.
Yeah.
And you get to go out there, you get to touch them and smell them, and sometimes you get to nibble on them, and you're in the forest and you're with a bunch of excited people, and you know, there's the real possibility of making a scientific discovery by finding a mushroom that hasn't been described yet.
Yeah. Well, it's supposed to maybe rain a little bit this weekend, which is always good. And people may be wondering out there, wow, it's been so dry. Once it starts to rain and it feels that moisture, do the mushrooms happily can't come up? You were just in Telluride, and what was it like?
Yeah, there were lots of mushrooms popping, but there was also dry places. You know, it was scattered and microclimates, but the ID table was full. And I feel optimistic about, you know, what we're going to forage this weekend. New York Mountain and Fulford and that area where we're going to be foraging around Yeoman Park and all there actually tends to get more rain than other places, generally speaking, in the Roaring Fork Valley and the I-70 corridor. But I set out to create an event that wasn't weather dependent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, like a bunch of great linear programming that can still entertain and inspire, regardless of whether or not we get the monsoon that we so desperately need. However, speaking to the expert Larry Evans, who's one of the founding members of the Eagle Mushroom Festival, he was very optimistic, and I trust his instinct, I trust his intuition, and I trust his lifetime of experience in knowing, you know, what the vibe is in the forest for mushrooms.
Well, really, it's chock full of so much, and you can buy a full pass and just go to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then can you also just go to individual?
That's right.
Pieces?
So it's $60 for the general admission pass.
Yeah, what a deal.
Which is, gets you into all the workshops and the lectures and the film fest. And then we have an a la carte menu. So if you wanted to go to just one workshop or just one lecture or a combination of your pick, we offer those separately. The forays are ticketed separately. It's $80 for, like, you know, we start at 8 and come back at 2, which is a long day.
Oh, wow.
And just an incredibly good bargain for what it's worth. But the $60 general admission is by far, hands down, the best bargain. And the reason for this is that, like, we don't want a barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for anyone who's curious about this stuff, we should make it as easy as possible for them to access.
Yes, everyone should go look at the schedule because there is so much. I mean, Martha Montemayor talking about psilocybin microdosing 101, which many, many people are curious about.
She's a fascinating woman. She's been doing brain scans on people for the last couple of years who are microdosing. She's going to share all that data with us on Saturday night.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds phenomenal. And then, oh, look who the closing keynote is, Hamilton.
Of course. You can't put all this work in without platforming yourself.
And I do love the red, white, and eternal Amanita muscaria, myth and medicine.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about Amanita in all of its various psycho-spiritual and chemical roles in our world, in our history, in our mythology, in our lore. It's a fascinating, iconic mushroom. For those of you who don't know, it's the emoji mushroom, the Mario mushroom, the one with the white dots and red skin. It's an amazing and beautiful mushroom that I'm going to share a lot of insights into if you're curious. Sunday night closing and then a huge pizza party.
All right. Well, let's get the webpage and where people can go to get tickets, or do they just show up? What's the full scale of participation look like?
Yeah, go to eaglemushroomfest.com to get your tickets, and make sure that you register. If you get the general admission, make sure you register through the process to get the workshops that you want that come with that. I sincerely hope that you consider coming. Kids are free. Kids are general admission free. Oh, my goodness. That's like so huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also just check out the full schedule. If you don't think you can make the whole thing, the forays alone look amazing.
To
be in the forests and learn so much. So, right now, the Eagle Mushroom and Wild Food Festival. Happening now, folks, so do not miss out.
Hope to see you there.
When obstruction blocks my way, I walk down that narrow way till I can see the light of day shining at the world. I realize something here sure is wrong. The stones that I throw will free all. Can walk right through this righteous land. He will know.
right. That's just a little Amy Helm for you. And you are tuned in to KD&K Express Yourself. I am in the studio with Hunter Hogan. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And her exhibition, along with Sarah Ransford and Sam Harvey, opens August 28th at the Art Base, and it's called A Sense of Place.
Yeah. Which is, well, A Sense of Place is going to mean something different to everybody that's been in this valley for a while. And I have been in this valley for over 20 years and in Western Colorado for 40. Yeah. And I didn't actually intend for my particular work to be botanic-based, mm-hmm. but that's what's happened. I got into this printing these plants and flowers, and my whole life has become thinking about how I can make a painting with them. And now Sarah, who I'm sure will be here any second, has a completely different idea of a sense of place. And Sam has been in this valley for a really long time. I'm sure his sense of place is different.
That's true. And Sam lives way up.
I don't know where he lives.
Oh, he lives way up near Pine Creek Cookhouse.
Oh, he does. Okay.
Yeah, so he's way up there in the Alpine. And a lot of Sarah's work is inspired by the desert as well.
Yeah, rocks and canyons and water and erosion. Mm-hmm. Her work is totally based on that. She makes a lot of sketches and then makes her clay beautiful, beautiful pieces, dimensional mm-hmm. pieces out of her drawings. And I make lots of drawings and of flowers and plants, and it's become so experimental, my process.
Yeah.
I found out that, you know, this tea bag paper becomes transparent when I glue it onto my paintings.
Oh, wow.
And I print the flowers and the plants on that and incorporate them, and I just keep getting bigger and bigger and trying to figure out and more colors and ways that things go together. There's no, it's always a surprise, mm-hmm. and sometimes they don't work. And, you know, I just look at them and study them for color and shape opportunities. And so it's really about the mountains and the, you know, what's growing.
Right, and what's around you. And I love you. You do have very big, beautiful canvases that
you
work on.
Thank you.
You talked a little bit like you didn't expect to be going into botanicals.
I didn't.
And how did that evolve?
Well, about 4 years ago, this jelly plate printing became a really big thing, and it kept popping up everywhere I looked online. And I finally tried it, and I thought, this is really fun. And then over the last couple of years, I've experimented more and more, and I've put multiple jelly plates together so I can print bigger and bigger and longer, taller and taller pieces. And it just became the most interesting thing with what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. I'm just loving it.
And you play with color a lot.
I love color.
So they aren't necessarily botanical colors.
No, but a sense of color, the color of harmony is important to me.
Yeah.
That colors work. And hi, Sarah. Hi. Welcome.
We have Sarah in the house. Yay.
Hi.
Hey.
So we're talking about a sense of place and what it means to you.
And talk right into that microphone.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here.
And we're
thank you, Amy, for doing this. This is awesome. I would say that every piece that I do is always about a sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moment in time of an image that I saw, whether I was walking, hiking, kayaking, climbing, all the things that I love to do, and I tend to zero in on real kind of close-up images, and it often is of rocks that have been impacted by water.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two themes run in my life, the water and the rocks, and so I capture those moments in time, and I tend to take a photograph, and then I'll do a lot of drawings from that, mm-hmm. and then eventually I'll make a ceramic piece.
And you work with paper as well.
I draw on paper. I work in paper clay.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So I mix
it's called paper clay.
Into the clay body.
Yeah. Right.
What is paper clay?
Yeah.
So paper clay, which the reason why I love working in paper clay is because it allows me to get super thin with the material and create these forms and tearing and doing some things that actually start to look like paper that you really can't do with just clay. And it creates these fibers. It's actually a clay slip that you mix in paper pulp, like that you make homemade paper with. Mm-hmm. And you mix that all together. And it's a process. Now I end up buying my own prepared paper clay, which I love.
Are you dyeing it, these colors? Because you've got all these beautiful earth colors in your new pieces.
Well, I do a lot of staining. I put stains into the slips that turn. So the clay is actually a colored clay.
Uh-huh.
So I've been really working a lot. It's kind of a format called or a term called Narokomi, where you work with a lot of colored clay, and I'm using it with my colored paper clay. And the reason why paper clay is so strong is because the fibers in the clay itself will adhere to each other, and they'll bond in a way that that doesn't always work with regular clay. And then when it fires that paper clay, the paper out, and so then it becomes more porous, and so you fire it higher. You have to treat it quite a bit differently than normal clay, but it also sticks together, and it absorbs glazes a lot better because of that porousness.
It's very interesting. For those of you out there that haven't seen Sarah's work, I mean, it is razor thin, some of these pieces. I mean, they're made from many razor thin pieces. It's like looking in the inside of a mountain or a river where there's just these layers, but it's so thin. It seems like there must be some trial and error that goes on in there, or you have it so down now.
You know, I took my first class from a woman named Rebecca Hutchinson, who is such an incredible artist, and she teaches in Mass Art in Massachusetts. I learned so much from her. I actually took one clay class and I never looked back. And it has taken some trial and error, but the cool thing about it is you can keep firing the pieces over and over again, and you can even take cone 10 fired pieces and add on new clay.
Wow.
Which is unheard of. You can never usually do that.
Yeah.
But that sense of place, I'm going to come back to that. It's even when I'm working on these pieces, I am so present and it becomes my place in that moment of working as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these decisions that I make that end up having nothing to do with maybe the original image that I saw. And it's how I take that image and then recreate it.
Okay. You know, that's interesting because a lot of, like, let's say mountain climbers or people that are in these situations where you just have to be so present to, you know, you can't be thinking of other things because it's dangerous, or you have to constantly read the water. Or so it feels to me like your journey on this art is the same thing. Like you have to constantly be present in there, and then it takes you where it will.
You know, I absolutely love that, Amy, because I think when I am in my best place and my healthiest place is when I am really present and in that moment. And you are absolutely right. When I'm climbing on that rock, I have to be right there in that moment or I'm going to mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't work for a few years when I had kids and some things. And my life was so chaotic and out of control. And when I started being able to go back into that studio and make it a practice, I centered myself in a way that I have never looked back, and I know how important it is for me to be in that studio or out there on the rocks or in the rivers. Just that is the thing that makes me
feel that
tick and work well.
So for you, Hunter, is it when you're in your process in your work?
I'm in the zone. I've been a painter since 1989, and before that I was a tapestry weaver. I just burn out on that. I couldn't do it any longer. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, you make crappy paintings for 10 or 20 years and then things start to move around. I have had really a wonderful time painting since about 2000 when I moved to California, and I just loved all those hills, and also in Loma, those beautiful hills and the grasses and the, you know, grassy hillsides. I just love them. And my painting took off, but it's changed many times in the last 26 years. Mm-hmm. And this new direction has been the last two or three years, and I'm just having a blast with it. And it's the only time I don't think about my physical ailments is when I'm working, because I have some. And I just love doing it. I mean, I love it. I do it until I just have to go get off my feet, you know. Mm-hmm. But I keep thinking of ideas. And, of course, the summer is better for me because of all the vegetation. And I go around with baskets and I just collect. And then I experiment what they can do and how they can look and what different colors. And, I edit them. And I don't care if I mix up two different, you know, stems. It's not about accuracy. And it's not about what plants grow here. Right. It's about shapes and color and how I can make something interesting out of that.
So, you know, I just learned while we were waiting for you that they created that place that I love so much, and that it was based on a South African
farmhouse,
which just makes all perfect sense.
Well, we were in Aspen working, and my husband was sick of his work, and we bought that land in 1990. And we didn't build a house until around 98 or 99. Uh-huh. All those years we camped. There's a little shed that we camped in. We had solar lights and everything. We loved those years. We had such a good time. And then we built our dream house, and we loved that. But we really wanted to try living near Tony's kids in California. We had grandchildren out there, and we decided it was time. Sarah and Bill were there next door, and they wanted it, and so we let it go. Been okay. You know, there were a lot of years where I felt like I lost my identity with that place, but it's fine now. It's actually fine, and it was all learning.
It's just funny how things are so synchronistic sometimes, and here you are.
And I love our connection that way. Basically spent from January to June doing most of the work that's going to be in the show, living in that house that Hunter and Tony created. And when we bought it, we bought some of Hunter's paintings that
that I want to redo.
That I love, and I've loved for so long. And it's rare that I can find a painting and put on my wall for 26 years and still be in love with
it. Well, thank you. That's nicest thing.
But I'm going to also say I now have one of her newer paintings in my new home here in Carbondale of Hunter's in this series, and I absolutely love it.
So you guys, we've got like 1 second before the news. So the show opens the 28th.
Next Friday, 5 to 7.
There's an opening. It will hang for
a month.
The 25th of September.
25th of September at the Art Base. You'll do an artist talk?
Yes.
At 5:30 on next Friday.
Real quick, how can people find out more about each of you?
Google me, Sarah Ransford.
Hunter Hogan. I'm easy to find.
I have a website, and I have Instagram and Facebook.
Same here. Instagram, Hunter Hogan Studio. So thank you.
Thanks for being here.